A local hospital eyes expansion, adding value to downtown and the region's health. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. Hope you had a good weekend out there. Just ahead as we kick off the work week, we've got a closer look at the future of UF Health JAX. You can get on the line now and join us. It's 549-2937. Then later, it was the state's biggest ever, worst ever mass shooting here in Jacksonville. That story is now being told on a local stage. Plus, it's Masters Week, and all eyes in the golf world are turning toward Augusta. Culpepper will take us up there later in the hour. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first, this hour, a new vision for UF Health in Jacksonville. Now, for many, UF Health, the former Shands, is still seen as the city's rundown safety net hospital located in a high crime area. But new findings are elevating this teaching hospital to identify its unique value to the city. And expansion is also on the agenda for UF Health JAX. Lots happening with this, and we want to kick off this Monday morning with a closer look as we welcome Dr. Leon Haley, the CEO of UF Health Jacksonville and Dean of the UF College of Medicine JAX. Good morning, Dr. Haley.
Good morning, Melissa.
And also with us, two members of a committee that studied UF Health. They are from the Urban Land Institute, Lindsay Haga, a committee volunteer, and Patrick Krachowski, a committee chair. Good to have both of you here as well.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us. It's 549-2937 as we talk about the future expansion of UF Health Jacksonville. 549-2937. Go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect at wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, and weigh in on Facebook as well. All right, Dr. Haley, let's begin with you. You recently underwent what's known as a TAP, a technical assistance panel study from the Urban Land Institute, looking at UF Health Jacksonville. What did this study find, and what was the purpose of it?
So the purpose, let me back up a little bit. We were looking at our downtown campus, which is composed of approximately 12 buildings, 3 million square feet, about 70 acres of space. And we've been trying to make a connection with the growth in Jacksonville, growth in downtown. And as we began to look at our own land, we wanted to look at the land that connects us between the hospital and downtown. Mm-hmm. We obviously don't have that expertise, so we sought some great resources in the community from ULI and their TAP study to help us look at our property and look at the age of our plant, the facility, potential growth opportunities. Then, more importantly, how do we connect to the rest of the city? How do we connect to Springfield, the community that we're in? How do we connect to downtown? How do we connect to growth? And what the study basically showed is that we have a great anchor for our institution, great healthcare anchor, but we have great partners in that space. So the VA is in that space, Darnell Cookman, which is one of the health magnet schools, FSCJ. And there is an opportunity to think about the UF Health as the anchor and sort of stretching that growth and development all the way into the downtown community.
What would that look like?
So we would envision sort of a redo of our campus. So we have to look at some of our aging facilities. So I'll step back and say we've had great support from the city. The mayor, city council has committed $120 million to our institution to support some refurbishing of our electrical system and our roof and some other very basic things. But there is an opportunity to think, study forward and look forward, you know, potentially a new hospital. We need new research and education space. We have a large College of Medicine, College of Nursing, College of Pharmacy. How can we expand that? But then also, how can we think about innovation, research labs, things that would help us connect to the rest of the city, both from an academic development, but also from an entrepreneurship perspective as well.
And if you think about UF Health, everybody, what comes to mind? What are your impressions and thoughts about UF Health Jacksonville? It is, of course, the home to Trauma One, this region's only level one trauma center, the Proton Institute, cutting-edge cancer treatment, and so much more. But as UF Health eyes expansion and change, we want to know what you think about this. 549-2937. Patrick, tell us a little bit more about this study, this TAP study, and some of the findings.
Sure. So the Urban Lands Institute is a global nonprofit education and research institute that's supported by members such as myself and Lindsay and many other focusing on responsible use of land in creating and sustaining thriving communities worldwide. So here in North Florida, we have the North Florida District Council, which was established in 2005. We have well over 520 some members at this point. We try to keep that going every day. But we also cover 34 counties. So we're Jacksonville to Gainesville, all the way out the panhandle to Pensacola. So a technical assistance panel is a two-day event where we do a lot of upfront work with a sponsor such as UF Health. We've done others for the city of Neptune Beach, Nassau County, JTA, Jacksonville University, and Renew Arlington. And what we're looking at are real estate and land use issues. And so we develop a scope of work with the sponsor to identify the issues they're facing. And then we go out and we search for panel members. It's usually 6 to 10 experts in varying fields, depending on what the scope of work calls for. But those usually focus on, obviously, real estate professionals, land planners, architects, financiers, developers, appraisers, land use attorneys, and brokers. We try to bring them from outside of the area, so they have a different perspective. So we search nationwide for these individuals. But we also try to have one or two panel members that are from the local area, so they can offer sort of the behind-the-scenes story, the character of the neighborhood type situation. And we bring them in for these 2 days. The first thing they do is they tour the area. So we put them on some type of vehicle, and they tour the area so they can see what's on the ground. And then they spend the better part of the second half of that first day interviewing stakeholders. Those stakeholders would be folks like Dr. Haley, city council person for that area, business owners.
Are people that can come and look at the actual physical plant and the neighborhood objectively.
Right.
Is that the important thing about this?
Very much so. We want them to be able to come in and have sort of an outside, unbiased, sort of brand new view.
And what was the view?
Well, Lindsay really spearheaded, I'm going to defer to her.
The view is that they have several strengths in this district. So if we imagine where the hospital is down to State Street and Hogan's Creek on the east, that was our study area boundary. So as Patrick said, our panel came in, they toured the facility, they had a learning invitation with Dr. Haley to talk about the hospital, just some of the activities that are going on, and that this is a learning, educational-based hospital, different from a different type of catalyst for that. The other strengths were to be build on the pathway, that connection, and realizing that UF Health is less than a mile from downtown. You can see that, as that's that distance. That geography is really close. But for the pedestrian experience, which there's 6,000 employees that come to UF Health, and mm-hmm. the patients and their guests, how do they connect, make that connection? So the panel saw you really have good structure. You have bones. You have partners that are already there. We have Florida State College that's there, Darnell Cookman. How can you partner? And then Hogan's Creek Greenway. And they saw that revitalization effort that's already underway, how they can build on that and come in and recreate their master plan.
So it sounds as though you see UF Health Jax as being part of revitalizing an entire sector of the city, changing this whole part of town.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we looked at our footprint and said, we're an academic resource for the city. So everybody knows us for trauma. Everybody knows us for cardiovascular care and stroke care. But we have a huge educational footprint, training residents, 360 residents on our campus every day, 63 medical students, 40 some odd nursing students, 237 pharmacy students. And how can they sort of in the campus that they exist, how can they connect with the rest of the city? So yes, we believe there's an opportunity to grow that campus and think about, you know, modernizing it, expanding it, but more importantly, connecting to the community, right? So if you're on our campus right now, it's essentially a food desert. Mm-hmm. So for our employees who want to go out and get something to eat, they have very, very few options. If they want to stop by a grocery store on their way home, almost no options. So mm-hmm. how can we, as we continue to grow, partner with Springfield, partner with the city to really revitalize that part of town?
It's 549-2937. Give us a call as we talk about the future and the expansion plan for UF Health Jacksonville. So what are the biggest challenges to address that? As you mentioned, you're in a food desert. You're in an area that's perceived to be a high crime area, although officially it's not more high crime than No. many other zip codes of town that don't have this reputation. You are in a part of town that is rapidly gentrifying, but still has this tag attached to it, which is a negative one. And it affects where people seek healthcare, frankly. You know, I can't count the number of times on this program over the last decade we've talked about Trauma One. We've talked about your incredible teaching hospital, the incredible physicians and disciplines, the Proton Institute, and so many other incredible things at UF Health Jax. But there are still many people in Jacksonville that would not go there for their health care because they have this inaccurate perception about what is there. And that, I think, just overcoming that perception is probably part of the challenge too.
Huge part of the challenge. And we spend a lot of time, I spend a lot of time socializing who we are. And so that is special thanks to you for having us on this program. That's multiple meetings with the mayor, with city council, with leaders in our community, to really start the conversation about all the great things that we do and changing people's perception. We're running a program right now that we call the Mini Medical School, where we're asking people to come in, spend Friday and Saturday evening or afternoon with us, and they get an opportunity to spend time on our emergency department, our cardiac care, meet with our great physicians and nurses, staff, usually have an interaction with either me as a senior leader, our research dean, our educational footprint, and learn. So we spend time trying to make sure we can educate people. Obviously, the bigger challenge will be as you go down the road and think about how do you want to support this? How do you want to finance that? So that's probably going to be a combination of, you know, partnership with the city, probably partnership with the state, the philanthropic community, the business community, and entrepreneurial community to make sure that people believe that this is the opportunity to reshape this part of town.
Patrick, that sounds exciting, but also I guess a heavy lift. How do you see this unfolding?
Yeah, I mean, the objective here is that we, you know, it's almost like when you're, when you're training for something, if you're not quite there, that's why you're doing the work. So when we look for a sponsor, we're looking for real problems that real experts can come in and really sink their teeth into and address. And it's a dynamic process. I mean, the second day of the panel, of the event, the panel members are behind closed doors and they're hashing these issues out. And I've seen them argue. I've seen them draw on the wall. You know, they really get into it. And what they generate immediately are some preliminary recommendations. And Lindsay has the better details on those. But then over the course of 6 to 8 weeks, they develop a written report that has information from their briefing booklet, information that they heard and saw. And our objective at ULI is to not generate something that just looks pretty, that somebody puts on a shelf and says, wow, wasn't that a great couple of days? But that it's really something that Dr. Haley and the city of Jacksonville, frankly, in this case, can take and put to work for the community. That's our overarching objective.
Okay. Yeah. And so, Lindsay, yeah, what are the final recommendations?
There's five top recommendations. One is to develop a health education district. Think of this as a master plan for that area where the hospital serves as the anchor. And when you have that master plan, you can do the second recommendation, which is to collaborate with the other educational and community health organizations within that district to feed off of those changes to the master plan. Then, as Dr. Haley mentioned, the third recommendation is the physical campus plan for the hospital. There's different facilities and buildings that would be changed or modified. And then the fourth, this touches on the financing aspect. How do you get the funding lift? We've all heard of community redevelopment areas. So one idea would be either to expand the downtown community redevelopment area itself and really also help anchor and pull in the hospital that it's part of downtown, or it could create its own community redevelopment area, which is a tax increment financing zone. So you could have that lift from investing in that zone. Lastly, if you think this is to link as UF Health as the anchor, to create a medical corridor down to Baptist MD Anderson. And that's 2.5 miles. That's a short, really short distance.
A medical corridor.
A medical corridor. And if you think a couple changes would happen when you analyze the land use and zoning, the land use pattern that's in that corridor from UF Health down to Baptist MD Anderson, you have a lot of public facility and land uses that would not right now encourage investment, entrepreneurial investment, like medical investment into the areas or any other entrepreneur or retail or housing that's needed in that area. So there's some land use changes that could happen within that corridor that would make it more vibrant. That corridor, I think the panel touched on that, one, because those are the assets that are in the area. But on day one, they got to meet with Audrey Moran out of Baptist MD to speak, and she's a social advocate, and you one say a potential competitor, but UF Health is the safety net hospital. They recognize by having UF Health around in their area, it really adds to our region. And they, the other stakeholders that they interviewed were Councilman Gaffney, Jake Gordon with Downtown, on that, to gain some more information to deliver those five recommendations.
And let's go to your calls now. How do you perceive UF Health Jacksonville? And what do you think of ambitious plans to expand UF Health and use it as an anchor for revitalizing Springfield and downtown, even creating a new medical corridor in the city? 549-2937. Give us a call right now. John is downtown. Hey, John, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa, and thank you so much for taking my call. You know, I'm excited about all the plans that appear to be developing. And let me just say, you know, with MD Anderson and Shands and, you know, your callers alluded to Hogan's Creek, you know, my biggest memory right now, or happiest memory, is recent, where I happened to have my picture taken with Smokey the Bear on Hogan's Creek.
Okay. But what about you? What about UF Shands? UF Health,
well,
rather.
The point is, you know, Smokey's federal. So anyway, there is legislation, House Bill number 9, that is currently looking at CRAs. And so what you're talking about with the heavy lift and financing is to bring in all these different partners and to create an unbelievable zone, you know, and expand on our DIA, our Downtown Investment Authority, and the CRA that we have for downtown that was created with 2014-560. So it's all good stuff, and I always get back to the waterways and how the health community perceives utilizing our waterways, you know, in this, you know, regional and actually global allure to bring people to Jacksonville.
Thank you, John. And thanks for making all of those points. Dr. Haley, everything comes down to money with these initiatives in the end. How will this all be financed? And, you know, UF Health in the past has struggled even to get the appropriate money it needs from the state to stay open as the region's only safety net hospital. And so funding's always a challenge for any big concern like yours, but how do you see this playing out?
Well, I think it's not going to be any one unique source. So I think we have really created a model where we're starting to think about who are our partners to make this process go forward. One of those partners is obviously the city. Like I said before, the city has been very grateful, along with city council, to support some infrastructure needs. And I think that's going to be one partner. We certainly believe our partnership with the University of Florida will be part of that. Our board directive from the university has now been to create one UF, one vision. And so we're thinking about our increasing partnership with the university, with Gainesville, and how we can support that. Clearly, the state will need to be involved on some level to support what some of those initiatives, obviously, just like the caller just mentioned. And what we're also really want to tap into is the other private entrepreneurial / philanthropic. We have not had a strong philanthropic background historically, but there's an opportunity to think about potential partners there, as well as we think about research and innovation, you know, who are those entrepreneurial partners that we can think of? So we don't have a price tag at this point. We're still in the preliminary phase of sort of thinking through this. But we think long term, long range, these are the things that we're trying to think through, along with thinking the right partners.
If you're successful, paint a picture for our listeners 10 years from now, 20 years from now. What will that medical campus and the surrounding neighborhood look like if you get your vision realized?
So I think you would have a thriving medical campus that includes an educational component, strong College of Medicine, strong College of Nursing and Pharmacy. I can see a renewed or new partnership with Darnell Cookman, potentially a new school for them to support their activities. I mean, even imagine the footprint of having a charter school that has middle, high school students who are interested in health education, sharing the same building with the College of Medicine, Nursing, and Pharmacy. I see a revitalized Springfield where there's grocery store, there's retail, there's potentially for student and workforce housing to support that. I see green space to support, you know, right now Hogan's Tree runs right through our parking lot. You know, how do you redirect that so that there's space for people to have? We see the partnership with Emerald Nicholas. And then obviously a large connection with the VA, FSCJ, working our way all the way down town, and then also through Baptist. We also have a partnership with JTA. We want to think about the pedestrian traffic. So that would envision. So models that are out there right now, something to think about would be the Texas Medical Center, which has a thriving academic footprint, things that Parkland is trying to do, Penn is trying to do. So that those are some of those visions.
Let's go to Yolanda. She's in Historic Springfield. Yolanda, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for taking my call. I kind of wanted just to comment and say finally thank you to the U.S. You know, U.S., which is formerly known as Shands, is a teaching hospital. And one of the primary reasons that I moved into Historic Springfield in 2013 was because of proximity to the healthcare as I age. And so although I am a citizen that does have health insurance, very good health insurance, I go to Shands, you know, or UF Health. And the University of Florida Health has been a teaching hospital for decades, you know, probably back to the 70s, if not earlier. And so I'm glad to see that UF Health is getting ahead and kind of reframing this the narrative about and expanding and actually using historic Springfield and areas like Durkeyville, and even to some of the historic value of where the hospital in Darnell Cookman sit, which is, you know, historically Black area. So I just wanted to say it's a great move. It's long overdue, and that it's, you know, it's going in the right direction to include, you know, incorporating downtown Jacksonville and perhaps expanding the CRAs. I think those things are the right thing to do. And once the message really, you know, the momentum is happening now, and, you know, with people like me and other advocates in Springfield and Durkeyville and the surrounding areas to include that downtown, I think people will finally get it about, you know, the, like you mentioned, Melissa, about crime statistics and how when you really look at it, it's really just an age-old perception that people have that's 20 years old. People haven't even been in the area. So I want to say great job. I'm glad to have you be hearing the show this morning.
Thanks, Yolanda. That's Yolanda Collin from Springfield. Here's a tweet from a listener. UF Health Jax is a great community asset. Civic engagement, good wages and benefits, amazing trauma care. As the city looks at development investments, UF Health should be key in that master plan with Jacksonville's future growth. Patrick.
Yeah, I think it would be a colossal mistake as we look at what's going on in and around downtown to ignore UF Health Jax. From ULI North Florida's perspective, we're looking at the Rail Yard District this year. We're looking at Northwest Jax CDC this year. We're working with Groundwork Jax and the Emerald Necklace. We've worked with the South Bank, the Cathedral District. I mean, these are all pieces that have to come together and realize what their particular asset is and how to develop it and how to expand on it. When I told somebody I was coming on today, I said UF Health Jax expansion, they said, well, development expansion, is that good or bad? You know, people hear development and they cringe, or they hear development and they get excited. And I think with what Dr. Haley wants...
Yeah, it depends
wants,
on where it is and right, who it affects, yeah.
Right. But I think this is, you know, when you ask Dr. Haley 10, 20 years, I mean, he's not the only one that's going to be experiencing this revitalization in the downtown area and an expansion of what we may consider our downtown core. All of these areas are looking at what they need to do, what their problems are, and they're significant. But, you know, ULI North Florida is trying to help with that and trying to bring the experts in to kind of give them that catalyst and light that fire.
Urban Land Institute really has done amazing work through the years in this city on projects like this. And as we talk about UF Health Jax, I would also encourage people to learn more about ULI. So it's good to have you both represented this morning. Lisa in Mandarin. Hi, Lisa. Good morning.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, thanks. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to say that my son has a rare inherited retinal disease, and there's no place we'd rather go than UF. because they have an amazing ophthalmology department and some really advanced equipment. There are some issues, though, and I have a lot of friends who have similar situations in their family, and they don't want to go there just because of the location. And I know we've sat there once before in the waiting room, and somebody from the jail came in with the shackles and everything else and an armed guard. So sometimes it can be a little scary.
Okay, thanks for that feedback, Dr. Haley.
We do not shy away from our mission, which is to heal, to comfort, to educate, and to discover. Included in that is being a community asset and our role as a safety net hospital. So we take care of anybody, black, white, rich, poor. Obviously, we have a relationship with the city to take care of the underfunded, and we take care of the prisoners. And so that is part of our collective body. That being said, we continue to emphasize the things that we do great. And we continue to emphasize our educational mission, our research mission. And so some of that is on a shared platform. Now, we obviously continue to focus on the patient experience and the things that we can do from a logistical standpoint will support that. Now, that being said, part of the challenge is some of our facilities are a little older. And so therefore, our ability to maximize the average patient with a prisoner are not ideal. And so I think as we think about future buildings, I think we can do a much better job of designing structures that support everybody.
Lindsay Hagel, let's close with you. What are the next steps for all of this?
The next steps are to continue to make those partnerships that we've had. We've identified some of our key partners, the city being one, some of the other assets, communities in the area. And then we can take in on creating those master plans. Dr. Haley mentioned that there's a campus plan that's underway of which facilities and buildings could get transformed. Part of that, if you were to look, it would be to identify some park space, some green space to build on the Emerald Necklace. So I would say as a land planner, we want to unlock some of the properties that are not at their highest and best use within that medical corridor so that the investment is attracted in that area and we start to see some of that transformation.
Well, thank you all three of you for being here on this Monday. Dr. Leon Haley Jr., CEO of UF Health Jax, Dean of the UF College of Medicine in Jacksonville, and two members of the ULI study on this, Patrick Krachowski and Lindsay Haga. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you for having
me. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Have a good morning.
Patrick, let's just mention that your garnet and gold bow tie is looking good here in the studio this morning. I know we wanted to make a quick mention of that, too.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Okay. Still to come, Culpeper, as all eyes head north of the border to Augusta. A little news for golf fans later in the hour. But up next, a new play, a new local original play exploring Florida's first mass shooting. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Back in a moment.
It was the S word 25 years ago, but now more and more people are identifying as socialists in America and on the ballot.
Whether millions of Americans at this moment are ready to call themselves socialist or not, one thing is true. There's a broad understanding that capitalism is not working for us.
Is socialism making a comeback? Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRX.
This afternoon at 3 here on 89.9 WJCT.
Get ready to explore the outdoors on International Migratory Bird Day at the Temuquan Ecological and Historic Preserve, Saturday, April 13th at 10 a.m. Join us for a great day exploring the outdoors and learning how to preserve and protect the habitat that migrating birds rely on and many birds call home. This fun, free family event is hosted by WJCT, the Temuquan Ecological and Historic Preserve, Temuquan Park Foundation, and Florida Park Service. To learn more, go to wjct.org/events.
I'm David Luckin, inviting you to listen to the Electro Lounge for the best downtempo and new jazz at 9 p.m. Monday through Saturday nights, only on 89.9 FM, WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, it was the worst mass shooting to ever take place in Florida. That is, until the shootings a few years ago at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando. Now, a new and original play tells the story of the GMAC mass shooting in Jacksonville in 1990. This is an original work by author and professor Tim Gilmore. It's called The Repossession of James Edward Powe, Mass Shooting in Bay Meadows. A piece of documentary theater that explores the origins and the aftermath of this 1990 tragedy. It will have a four-day run at FSCJ beginning April 11th. Here now, we're pleased to welcome Tim Gilmore. Good morning.
Hey, Melissa.
Ken McCulloch, professor of theater at FSCJ and director of this production. Good morning.
Good morning.
And two actors in the show, Alan Melton and Autumn Franks. Good morning to you.
Hi.
Okay, Tim, let's start with you. This was the state's worst mass shooting. 10 people killed, including the shooter. Mm-hmm. That is until Pulse. Right. It was in 1990, so it's sort of faded from a lot of people's memories. You're bringing this back to the forefront with this play. Tell me a little bit more about the production.
Yeah, that's true. So, you know, at the time this happened, mass shootings were not nearly as common as they are now. And it seemed to be totally, a freak occurrence at the time. And so as we've seen so many of these things, I had GMAC in the back of my head that I was something I needed to know more about. I didn't remember a whole lot. I was a teenager when this happened. I wanted to find out more. I wrote a story about it for my website right after the Parkland shooting, and lots of people responded, including people who said I was there, or I'm a survivor, or a family member was a survivor, and so I had to ask, would you mind speaking with me? And so. At first, I didn't know exactly. I knew I wanted to do something with something larger, but I didn't know exactly what. And in speaking with several of these survivors, family members, first responders, it became obvious to me that nothing I could write would be as powerful as their words. So, their words, the words of the people who were connected to the event are the vast majority of the play, just kind of orchestrated in the larger story.
And James Edward Powe, the killer, he did this horrible act. It was a car loan office down on Bay Meadows Road. That's where this happened, right? To sort of reorient people's memories.
Yeah, that's right. This. Yeah.
Okay.
And it's interesting, there's lots of confusion about how to say his name. Actually, several characters.
Did I mispronounce it?
Well, several characters in the play say his name differently, and that's intentional.
Okay.
Yeah, it's actually Pugh, but people people say Pugh, Powell, Poe, Huff. Yeah. Right. So this was the GMAC, General Motors, Acceptance Corporation is what that stood for. It was on Bay Meadows Way. The building is still there. Like you said a minute ago, it was 1990. And, of course, when something like this happens, people want to know why, and they want a narrative that makes things make sense. So the response in the news and amongst people talking about it right afterwards was, he did this just because his car was repossessed. And of course, there's no justifiable reason for something so heinous. People's lives are haunted, for as long as they're still here.
Sure.
When they go through something like this. But it's too neat of an answer to say, although headlines at the time said it, that he did this just because his car was repossessed.
But of course, he was more deeply troubled than that.
Right.
Okay, so Ken, this is your 50th production at FSCJ.
Yes, it is.
Which is really exciting and quite a milestone. What's it like, though, to direct something like this, which is about something that happened in Jacksonville? This is a new original local work. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's been an honor to direct Tim's work again. We collaborated 2 years ago on another script of his dealing with a chapter in Jacksonville history. And I directed the Laramie Project a few years ago based on the murder of Matthew Shepard that was taken directly from interviews with people in Laramie who knew him and knew the perpetrators. And so this reminds me a lot of that docudrama that I directed, and but even more resonance with this because it's here in Jacksonville. These people are still around this area and still live here. And so that sense of obligation and respect when we are playing people who are actually alive and were affected by this and will be affected by it for the rest of their lives has been kind of an exciting experience for me and the cast.
Sure. Let's talk to the cast. Alan Melton and Autumn Franks, two actors from the show. Alan, who do you play?
I play the reporter for the entire interview process of the show.
So you're the reporter that's covering mm-hmm. this tragedy. Mm-hmm. And what has that process been like for you?
The process has been very different from any other character that I've played because, you know, this isn't a heavily emotional piece. This isn't comical. This is really nitty gritty. This is really me trying to like find the answers as to like what could make someone do something like this from the perspectives of the survivors and friends and neighbors.
And Autumn, what's your role?
I play Lara. I am the daughter of one of the survivors that was there. So her mom was at the shooting.
And so your role, I guess, helps people understand the impact mass shootings and gun violence has on families in America.
Yeah, definitely. She goes on a couple little speeches about how this affected her family and how it affected her and her years in college, her whole life.
So Tim Gilmore, when this happened in 1990, it was seen as such a freak thing, such an anomaly. And in the years since, in the intervening years, it's become a regular occurrence in American yeah. life.
Right.
Which I think when people go and see this production, they can reflect on that.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and one of the things that, you know, Lara, played by Autumn, you know, says is how frustrated she is that this happens over and over and over. And it seems like the headlines always stay the same. And, you know, she says in at one point, you know, what kind of country, in what kind of country do the teachers have to carry guns, which is, of course, a debate that's happening right now. And it's frustrating. And when you look, in fact, at American statistics versus statistics from other wealthy nations, the United States is just almost a different planet. And that's also the New York Times did a fascinating study of that where they charted out the likelihood of gun deaths in other countries compared to truly freak occurrences in the United States, like, you know, dying from falling off a ladder or from being struck by lightning. That's how rare gun deaths are in most other wealthy nations. And, you know, it's something that, I mean, at what point do we finally do something, whatever it is, you know, at what point?
How do you see art, Ken, in contributing to the national discussion about this issue?
Well, there are a wide variety of opinions from the characters in the play about gun rights and about this issue. So, and those voices are heard on either side of this issue. So I think getting that debate going and talking about the pros and cons of assault weapons versus pistols versus shotguns and finding some sort of common sense, maybe common ground there, maybe something that this play promotes and can get that discussion going. But we did, you know, because both sides are there and because I think some people might presume that this is going to be kind of a anti-NRA play or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's really not. It's a real kind of a balanced opinion based on these people that were affected by this.
It's if I can add to that real quickly. I mean, it's incredibly important, of course. I mean, we're like Ken said a minute ago. The play needs to treat with deep respect the issue, the actual story itself, and the real people whose lives were affected by this. So, you know, there are people in the play who feel very strongly on both sides of the gun issue. And, you know, those are their voices. And so their voices are represented in the play.
Have you heard from people still living in town that survived this or were affected by this? What kind of feedback are you getting from people?
You know, so I let everyone whom I interviewed, you know, obviously know that this was happening. And they have, I think understandably, most of them have not expressed a desire to see it, although one of the survivors and it makes sense with her personality now that I know her a bit, asked to read the play. So I sent it to her and she read the play. You know, a couple have said that they might come out. Again, there's a huge just responsibility to treat this with all the respect and sensitivity possible.
Alan and Autumn, have you talked to any survivors of the shooting?
I have not.
One of the big things though we talked about as a cast mm-hmm. was if the people do come this, you know, we're actors, we're used to playing characters. This isn't a character, this These is a people. Person. You know, so we wanted to make sure we paid respect to the person and not try and make it a character in case they did come and see it, or just people in general came to see, they saw real people, not characters.
Mm-hmm. Right. And it wasn't really necessary to try to, we weren't going to try to copy them or imitate them vocally or with their mannerisms or anything like that. First of all, there's a significant age difference between,
yeah. between we weren't born in 1990.
Right. Between yeah. these people and this cast. So
it were was, you guys alive in 1990?
I was on my way.
You were on the way. Okay.
95. So yeah.
Okay. That you were just a gleam in there in your parents' eyes. Oh my gosh. That is something, isn't it? Okay. So with all of that said, this is really exciting to see a new work from Tim Gilmore, who is the author of 27,000 books. Actually, it's 17. Actually, it's 17 books.
That's prolific.
It just feels like you've authored 27 million books.
You threw me for a second
there. Because every time I turn around, you've written a new one. It's quite amazing. And now a new play from you as well. So go see this new production. It is a new local original production telling the story of the GMAC mass shooting in Jacksonville in 1990. It's called The Repossession of James Edward Pugh, Mass Shooting at Bay Meadows, a four-day run at FSCJ's Wilson Theater. That's at FSCJ South on Beach Boulevard. It's Thursday through Sunday. Kudos to all of you, author Tim Gilmore, Ken McCullough, professor of theater at FSCJ, directing his 50th production with the school this April. Autumn Franks, actor, and Alan Melton, actor in the show. Break a leg to both of you. And thank you all for being here so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Happy to be again, here. That production is Thursday through Sunday at FSCJ South. A quick break, and in a moment, it's Masters Week, and all eyes in the golf world are turning to Augusta, Culpeper. We'll take us up there for that and some more sports news and notes here after this break. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Back in a moment.
On March 2nd, 1800, two men had an altercation in downtown St. Augustine that resulted in one of the men's death. Both men were slaves. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll discuss this fascinating murder investigation with Jim Cusick. We'll talk about 19th century property surveys in Florida and the Central Florida Navy League. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
In basketball, three-point shots are game changers, and today more players are attempting the shot than ever before.
Shooting more three-pointers speeds up the game, which as we become more and more attention deficit culture, that is a benefit for the NBA.
I'm Amy Scott, cracking the three-pointer code with a data scientist. That's next time on Marketplace.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Pain relief and stress relief, the ads are telling us that CBD works wonders.
There's this long list of things, insomnia, anxiety, pain, acne, even really serious diseases, but we just don't know yet what it works for.
That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.9 WJCT.
Hurricane Harvey caused $125 billion damage. Many are still paying the price.
Where were you when we needed assistance? Where were you when the contractor took our money and didn't come back?
Rebuilding trust and community. We head across America to Houston. Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Sports Wrap-Up with Cole Pepper is sponsored by Black Sheep, Orsay, and Bellwether Restaurants.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, it's Masters Week, and all eyes in the golf world now turn toward Augusta.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
All right, Cole Pepper is here to tell us more about the first major of this season. I want to do my Bill Murray impression now from Caddyshack.
Tears in his eyes, I guess, as he lines us up. That's about right. To become Masters champion.
Cinderella story.
Cinderella story.
That's right.
Well, we'll see if there'll be a Cinderella story this year. It's the first major if you don't count the players, and technically it is the first major of the season. But certainly Augusta National, the tradition-laden club that hosts the event, did show some progressive thinking when they debuted the Augusta Women's Amateur this year. On the same course, the best golfers in the world will play this week. Female amateur golfers, mostly college golfers, competed. And defending NCAA champion Jennifer Kupcho won the title. Then yesterday, the national finals of the drive, chip, and putt competition included two local golfers, 11-year-old Bryson Hughes and 15-year-old Andrew McLaughlin. Bryson, who plays on the Fruit Cove Middle School team, finished 9th in his age group, while McLaughlin, who plays for Bulls, finished 8th in his age group. But you have to see some of the shots made by some of the young golfers at this event. Couple of 30-foot putts drained by youngsters to win. What a moment for those. And everybody gets to then, after competing in this, each age group had 10 finalists. Everybody and their families gets to go out to the practice rounds today at Augusta National. So pretty good experience for those youngsters.
That's fun. You know, I know families that make a whole week out of this. They go up there and they get a place to stay. This is a big rite of spring for them.
It really is. And I know a lot of folks around town who really do make it an appointment on their calendar every year. I've been up to Augusta National a couple of times week of the tournament. And the two things that you don't understand about Augusta National until you get up there are, number one, the elevation changes. TV doesn't do justice how much, you know, there are some serious hills that the players will play through, particularly coming up 18. But also, I think it's the greenest place I've ever been, Melissa.
Yeah,
it is
yeah.
unbelievably green and clean. And when you can walk out of there with a pimento cheese sandwich for like $2 and a quarter, it's a pretty good situation when you go to experience a tradition unlike any other. And this year, I'm picking John Rahm to win the Masters. Kevin Kisner, the former Georgia Bulldogs, my dark horse. Odds makers, by the way, like Rory McIlroy, the defending Players Champion, and Dustin Johnson, the world's number one player, as their top picks.
Okay, we'll have to see. You have a pretty good track record on your golf picks. So
decent.
We'll see how that goes. Okay, the Icemen have made the playoffs. That's exciting.
Yeah,
let's talk a little more about their fortunes.
Last night they found out who they would face in the first round. It is the top seed Florida Everblades. Games 1 and 2 were Thursday and Saturday in Estero down by Fort Myers. Then games 3 and 4, and if necessary, game 5 are in Jacksonville a week from Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. And this afternoon, the mayor is going to make some kind of an announcement or proclamation about the Icemen as well. So
just to
in
give
their
them
second,
some props.
A little extra, yeah, a little mayoral pat on the back. And with the second season in town, the Icemen going to the postseason. It is a tough matchup for sure. The Everblades have the second best record in the league, so we'll see how it all plays out. But you've got to play it on the ice, and once playoff hockey starts, that you know that means everybody start growing your beards.
That look more
the
like
playoff
you.
Beards, yeah.
Yes. Okay. Congratulations, Cole says, to the Westside Wolverines.
Yeah, U19 rugby team won their semifinal match Saturday to earn a trip to the state finals. They'll face Cardinal Gibbons for the title on Saturday. This is a lot of kids, some of whom play high school football as well, but they've really done well second straight year that they've gone deep into the tournament from rugby, which is a growing sport, to be sure, around the state.
Yeah, that's interesting to watch. And last but not least, just 17 days away from the start of the NFL draft.
Yeah, and in the next couple of weeks, we're going to be talking more about who the Jaguars could be targeting with the 7th overall pick. Right now, I'm actually saying it's going to be a defensive lineman. I reserve the right to change my mind as we get closer. I think a lot of fans probably won't be too happy with that. They want help on offense, but I don't think there's somebody who fits at number 7 who's likely to be there, who's going to be somebody who can make an impact for the Jaguars right away. And remember, Tom Coughlin, when he won Super Bowls with the Giants, had loads of pass rushers. And in this day and age in the National Football League, if you can find guys who can rush the passer, that is a real benefit. So don't be at all surprised, even though the Jaguars have more strength on defense than offense, if they don't go with a defensive player in that first round.
Always good to have you every Monday. Follow Cole on Twitter at Cole Pepper. Watch him every night on Channel 4. Always good to have you on the show. Thanks for all of this. Have a great week.
Thanks, Melissa.
That is our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers today. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. And we always want your feedback. Send emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. 1A is up next. And on tomorrow's show, why a local trivia host is taking over the trivia world. Find out more about his podcast. That and more tomorrow. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back here at 9 a.m. Tuesday. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.